I've been accumulating my wisdom in this space for a couple of decades now, and so today I'm going to share with you the most important lesson I know about in economics in just one short lesson.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone. Dr. Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity here, back with you. And this is a really important episode for me. Beware the peak. Want the economy in just one short lesson. So if you're confused about why things are happening the way they are, you want to have an explanatory function for understanding how things are unfolding, I've got that for you here. And it begins with this, though, my concern. My concern is that our leaders, they know a lot that just ain't so. You know, Mark Twain said it best, it ain't what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. So if you have the wrong narrative, if you have the wrong story, things can break on you. So one of the stories that our leaders have had for a long time in the United States is that debts don't matter, right? Dick Cheney famously snarled that at the camera way back when. Debts don't matter, right? We can just constantly get our debts going up higher and higher and higher all the time as a nation, at the federal level, at the state level, at municipal levels, at personal, corporate, just more debt, more debt. We're going to tear that apart because it's really wrong. And we're going to connect it to the most powerful piece of information that has come out this year from the U.S. government. It begins with this idea, federal debt, clearly unsustainable. We noted here a while ago, I think I noted this chart in 2024 sometime, and it's only gotten worse since. The U.S. has added $11 trillion in debt since 2020, and it took 220 years to reach the first $11 trillion in debt. And obviously, that's an exponential chart, and it's increasing exponentially. You know, that's not a problem. You know, if Bill Gates' debt is increasing, but his income is increasing faster than his debt, who cares, right? Here's the problem. Jerome Powell said this in front of the Senate Finance Committee on Monetary Policy. He said this to Cynthia Lummis. He said, quote, "The problem is that we're on a path where the debt is growing substantially faster than the economy, and that, by the definition, in the long run, is unsustainable." There it is. That's Jerome Powell commenting on debt, which really isn't his bailiwick, right? He's a monetary policy guy. Congress have to deal with the deficit and the corresponding federal debt. That's the federal debt, but it's even worse than that. When we widen out and we look here now at total, well, let's start here. Let's go to gross domestic product, GDP, right? And that's in billions of dollars. So 20,000 billion would be 20 trillion. So gross domestic product, GDP, then, well, this is our income. This is, you know, it's goods and services, it's stocks and flows of stuff in the economy. But this is basically how we earn our way as we all get up and we go out and we work and we do things. Farm, fix HVAC machines, create beautiful PowerPoint presentations for our consulting company, whatever we do, it all sums together into something called GDP, gross domestic product. So that's that line. And the problem is when we combine it with this red dotted line here, which is all sectors, debt and securities and loans. This is everything. It's called TCMDO, total credit market debt outstanding in the Federal Reserve System, which is the FRED system. I really like that they have this system. It's very good. So the Fed does at least something good. I like that. I like the FRED system. But this orange line right here, dotted line, that's total debt. And you can see it's over 100,000 billion, which is 100 trillion. So yeah, the federal debt's going like crazy gangbusters, but it's total debt. We live in an entirely indebted country. And so this is the main problem of unsustainability that Jerome Powell is talking about. So we have to talk about how does this resolve? Because this makes all your decisions kind of clear. What do you invest in? What do you not invest in? You know, do you need to get a resilient homestead? Should you, you know, renew your passport? A lot of important questions to resolve about this. And by the way, this idea set applies to pretty much the entire Western world right now, including Japan in that statement, because we all have way too much debt and not as much or too little of this stuff, which is the income to support the debt. Lot of debt, not enough income. That's the problem here. Okay. And so again, it's that The problem, it's unsustainable if your debt is growing faster than the economy. That's the problem. All right, all that debt. So we have to have a plan, though. What is the plan? How are we going to start to fix this, right? And so the Trump administration came in, and in January, they were talking about we're going to cut a couple trillion out of the spending, right, which would be a great thing because the government had added about $2 trillion in spending because of COVID and then forgot to take it off the books. Always easy to slap on more spending. Really hard to get it back off the books. So they were going to cut spending, and they wrestled with that for a while, and they had DOGE, and they ultimately threw in the towel on that and went this path. And now Scott Bessent is out there saying, well, we're going to have growth like we haven't seen since post-World War II. That's it. We're going to have growth. Growth is how this gap gets closed up. We're going to drag the green line up at a faster pace than the red line is growing. So we're going to close the gap. And we're going to do that as a nation. We're going to do that at the federal level, state, all that. That's the plan. Now, here's where this gets goofy. So here's something we're going to have to cover very quickly. What is money, right? Money is a claim on stuff, right? If I have a $100 bill, I could go to a store and claim some stuff, right? I could buy lawn mowing services from somebody, right? A back rub, a service, right? Or I could buy stuff, imported Chinese stuff from Amazon. Doesn't matter. But money is a claim on stuff. But that's a claim that can be exercised right now, today. Which is why if you create too much money, you create inflation, because you create a lot of money and it starts claiming a lot of stuff. And then the prices of that stuff gets bid up, right? Inflation is not the prices of apples and oranges going up. Inflation is the value of money compared to apples and oranges going down. So money's a claim on stuff, but it's a claim on stuff. This is a temporal argument. It's a claim on stuff right now. Okay. Debt, however, is a claim on future money. So if I take out a debt of $100,000 today that's due in a year, I don't have to pay it back for a year. So it's a claim on $100,000 in a year, right? So it's a claim on future money. All right. Well, you put those sort of ideas together, and it says that when you constantly, if you're growing your debts at a faster pace than your economy, you're making the explicit and implicit bet and assumption that that future economy is going to be big enough to pay off the debts that were taken out today. Does that make sense? Right? If debts are constantly growing, sooner or later, this part has to catch up again. The economy has to catch up. Now, this is where the story gets super fascinating, because we're going to have to examine where that growth comes from. These are all the core arguments that I put forth in the crash course, first in 2008, got updated in 2011 and 2013. And we're updating the crash course again because it's this idea set that's really powerful, really potent. And it connects two things together that need to be connected. Well, multiple things, but two big things that seem to be missing. Things that we just know for sure that just ain't so, right? Which is that, oh, the economy can always grow. Oh, debts don't matter. These are things we know because we've repeated them over and over again. But what if they're not true? What if those are things we know that just ain't so? So here's my question. What if we get this outcome instead? What if Scott Bessent is wrong and we can't find a way to really substantially, you know, really get GDP fired up? And I'll show you what those challenges are going to be. And debt just keeps on its current trajectory. Can it continue like that forever? Well, the answer is no, obviously. That breaks at some point. And when it breaks, that could be really ugly. And you better be prepared for that and just in case. All right. Now, let's talk about this economic growth. Where does growth come from? So when we say growth, what we really mean is more things this year than last year. More things. What kind of things? Well, if we're in the commodity space, you know, it's like you see these, I love this flow chart. So coal over here, if we start with coal way up here, we mine the coal, which takes energy, right? And then it flows over and we use it to make things. Or we might use a little bit of coal to build things, right? Like, you know, you make steel out of it. Or you might use coal to fuel and power certain things, or we might use coal to move things, right? Or feed people, or, you know, care. All right. So same thing for iron, copper, gold. All of these things don't come out of the ground for free. They take energy to come out, and then we do things with them, and we either make, build, or power, or move things around. That's when we say an economy, what's it really doing? Well, it's making things. It's building things, it's repairing things, it's providing fuel and power for all those activities, or we're moving things. Things are built in China, they're sold in the US, etc. So that's growth. So if we're saying we want growth, we're fundamentally saying growth comes with using more coal, more iron, more copper, more gold this year than last year to do various things. Now, if you think about a GDP as goods and services, gross domestic products, really goods and services, and if we broke it all the way down and said, well, what's in a household? What does a household spend its money? A household has a certain amount of income. So if the average annual expenditures are $77,300 in the U.S., 25.4 of that, roughly a third, goes into housing. 13.2 goes into transportation. So that's fueling your car, buying replacement cars, maintaining the cars, all that. Then there's personal insurance and pensions. So some get saved off for a rainy day or used to insure against disaster. Healthcare, which I call sick care. Food, right? Food away from home. And then various other things like that. So that's GDP. If you want to have more GDP, then the household next year, instead of spending 77.3, is going to be spending more than that. It'll spend 80,000, and that would be growth, right? Because we're that a single household is spending more on these sorts of things. All right. If we looked at it by industry in the United States, broken down by various trillions of components, right? Manufacturing, $2.9 trillion, clocking in there. You got real estate at $3.3 trillion of yearly activity. So this is 2023. Private industry's total is $23.5 trillion. Government's another 22% of that higher, you know, over the overall economy. So there's wholesale trade, retail trade, construction. So when we say GDP, it's people making and doing things, They're providing services like food and hospitality, or they are, you know, state and local workers, or they're making things like houses or providing healthcare or manufacturing things. So when we say we want the GDP to grow, and Scott Bessent says we're going to make the GDP grow faster than it has at any point since World War II, he's saying more people at work doing more things. That's the economy. It's that simple. Okay, so what causes people to do more things so we can get more of this growth? All right. First, we're going to hear from our advertiser very quickly, my favorite sponsor, Vault. We'll be right back, and I'm going to be talking about this thing that we have colossally wrong and connecting it to the most important piece of data, information that's come out of the U.S. government this year. Hi, I'm Dr. Chris Martinson. The news isn't just wrong. It's a lie, and it's costing you. Inflation's a freight train. Resources are vanishing, and they're still peddling the everything's fine story. Well, I'm done with it. As your information scout at Peak Prosperity, I rip through the web, reports, raw accounts to expose what's real. Energy crises, economic unraveling, all backed up by hard evidence. And I'll correct myself if I miss, but I won't stop. You're in the crosshairs of this mess. Subscribe now, see the truth, and fight back with me. Welcome back, everybody. Let's dive in now and talk about this. Look, this is something that a lot of people have wrong. They have this very wrong. They say that, oh, energy is a subset of the economy. It's just one of many things we do, Chris. We get energy, all these other things, but energy is a subset of the economy. When in fact, when you think about it for a little while, it turns out that the economy is a subset of energy. That if you have energy, you can have an economy. If you don't have any energy, you can't have an economy, right? And energy could be what you're thinking of, like electricity coming out of the wall, which is actually power. It could be a fuel source like fossil fuels, nuclear, something like that. Or it could be food energy, right? Just imagine we have no coal, no oil, no nuclear, no electricity, and no food. Obviously, we're just going to waste away, and we're not going to have any bodily energy to do anything like build a hut and start creating a GDP out of that. No. The economy is a subset of energy. If you have energy, then the economy is possible. Now, it sounds like a heretical idea to economists, but the data is really powerfully strong here. There is no such thing as a low energy rich country. If it was possible for this to not be true, if it was true that this was true, that energy is just a subset of the economy, somebody somewhere, somehow in this world would have figured out how to create a very rich, low energy country. Hasn't happened. In no country in the world has this been worked out. And this is electricity consumption per capita up the y-axis and GDP per capita, people doing things, across the bottom axis, the x-axis there. And you can just see that there's a very clear relationship here. A little bit of a curve to this line if I was going to draw a little curve here, but basically more electricity consumption, you have a richer country. That's electricity. What about total energy? This is everything, all energy from all sources, nuclear, alternatives, fossil fuels, biomass, all the big categories, all the energy slapped into one spot in the world and then measured against total world GDP. What do you see? You have this almost perfect straight line relationship saying that more energy being consumed from all those sources I just mentioned, plotted against total GDP output, each one of these X's being a year in the series, you see this almost perfect line. So energy and GDP, obviously it makes sense, right? Because it takes energy to move things, make things, build things, etc. Even if I'm just providing a service, I'm a masseuse, I provide masseuse services. Well, I still have to eat. I still have to drive a car, probably have to have an office, which is maintained at a certain temperature. All of that is energy. So once we look at this, not in dollar terms, but in energy terms, the world gets really, really clear. And in particular, when we look at this in oil terms, a similar chart to the one we've just been seeing. We saw one for total energy. We saw one for electricity. This is oil. In this case, GDP is now on the y-axis. So higher up this y-axis, more GDP. And this is thousands of barrels of oil consumed per day. This is in the globe, according to the globe. This is not just any one country. So it's the whole world. And so 90,000 barrels per day would be 90 million barrels per day, because 1,000 times 1,000 is 1,000,000. All right. Yep. Again, look at this R squared. It says 93.932. 0.932 means there's a 93.2% explanatory power between the amount of oil consumed and the amount of economic output that you would observe in any period. So if you said, Chris, 5 years from now, this is how much oil the world is producing, what's your guess as to how much economy we'll have then? And my answer will be 93% accurate. This is such a solid relationship right here. And it's just intuitively accurate, right? It makes sense. It tracks, because this is the economy. There are people doing things, going to work, coming from work, trucking stuff going around, moving things from A to B, coming from the ports to the ports, whatever they're doing. Oil, 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 oil. The more of these things, like if there were no trucks on the road and none moving, you probably have a pretty low economy, but you're also burning a lot less oil. If you want to have more economy, you're going to have more oil consumption. Now, this brings us to the most powerful piece of information that the U.S. government has released this year. But first, we had warning signs. We had warning signs back in May. So the U.S. drillers say that the peak shale oil output in the shale patch has arrived. That's what the shale drillers have been saying for a while. But then the government, at the EIA, the Energy Information Administration, the EIA, as a subset of the Department of Energy, came out and produced this chart in their annual energy outlook for 2025. And here we're looking at total energy production. This is just crude oil and least condensate. It's called C plus C, crude and condensate. And we can see that it goes up for a while, and they said, oh, it's going to start peaking in 2028, and it's going to flatline for a little while, and then it's going to slowly start wandering down. But that is a peak. This is a giant watershed moment. Once the shale peaks, that's kind of it. Now, there might be more offshore, there might be more in Alaska, but man, we better get on that really quick if we don't want to experience a peaky peak. But the problem here is then, well, we're not ready for this at this point. We're just not. The United States is not ready for this. And our only option, once this is passed, we get past the peak, is we're going to still need that oil if we want to maintain our economy, if we want to somehow fund our exponential debt growth. Like, if we don't have any plan for this and we're just sort of storming into peak oil without a real plan around that, we're going to find that we're going to have to compete on the open world stage in open markets, unless we're going to fight somebody for it, which is a possibility. We're going to have to compete for those marginal barrels, which means the price of oil is going to go up, which means we're going to suddenly find out that $100 trillion of debt that's affordable at $60 a barrel oil is completely unaffordable at $100 per barrel oil. And we're not ready for that. So if there's no plan and we don't know what we're going to do about this, and our only plan is, don't worry, we're going to get the bottom to grow really fast, the bottom line there, GDP, I just worry that this just sort of blows up on us. Pow. Right? That's what's going to happen. Now, I'm going to be talking about this in really great detail and length at the Limitless Conference that I'm going to be at out in Texas, which is Ken McElroy's show out there. Great show. That's coming at the end of July here, and first weekend, end of July into August. I'm going to be speaking about this, but in much more detail. So what if this is true? What if we get this instead? What if there's no plan? The plan is, let's just pretend this isn't a problem. Nobody's really thinking about what this means. And we just sort of sail into this. And next thing you know, in a couple of years, we find we have oil at $200 a barrel, or $150 or $100 or whatever the number is, and we can't afford it, and our debt markets blow up. Okay? Well, there's only one obvious answer. The way that all prudent adults need to hedge their bets in this whole thing is to become more resilient. And this is what we do at Peak Prosperity. We talk about resilience, home, health, wealth, and community. But here we're talking about home and health, obviously healthy foods. You want to grow as many, remember, plant a garden, right? Grow what you can. You want to become as resilient as you can, being less dependent on the overall systems out there, so that you are as resilient or as self-reliant as possible. And hey, you could divvy this up around your community, where you might be the carrot meister, right? But other people might be better at other things that you don't particularly want to have to take care of. I'm not saying we all have, each household becomes its own island, but we want to be more resilient in terms of energy at the home, how many different redundant systems we can use in our home to keep it warm, to keep it cool, to keep ourselves safe. Health includes that idea of safety, but also emotional health, spiritual health, physical health, all of that's true. Everybody's got to start thinking about how they're going to protect their wealth in this environment, because this is one of the most dynamic environments we've ever seen. And if what I'm talking about here, with the United States sort of blithely sailing into a peak oil future, which it seems to be, then we're going to have some exceedingly large challenges that are going to be highly disruptive and create a lot of what they call volatility in the overall markets, which is why you want to have a risk managed strategy. And of course, we partner up with Kiker Wealth Management. So if you're interested in having your wealth examined, looked at, poured over, and so you can develop a plan and a goal, go to peakfinancialinvesting.com. And then for community, your physical community is going to be very important. Whatever many preparations you make, you're only actually as safe as your community, as your neighbors. And so building your social capital and really leaning into your community is very important. That's something Evie and I are doing here in our own local community. I'm hearing about more and more people doing that, finally becoming involved and doing more. I was late to that game, but now I'm in it. And it's vitally important, because this is the only thing I can actually have some control over, and I can have some influence over very directly. So that's important. But while we're sort of watching all this unfold and staying oriented and understanding what the things are and making sense of the right data and seeing the signal for the noise, your virtual community is going to be exceedingly important. So I would invite you to come back to peakprosperity.com, become a member, and you can see here we have like lots and lots of conversations. These are really rich, meaty conversations in those comments, with extraordinary talented people in here discussing all of these things openly and without any limits. We do complete free speech at Peak Prosperity, meaning we're willing to go into any topic provided you bring the data. Unqualified opinions that just sort of get spouted out don't tend to go far in our community. But if you want to have a rich, adult-sized, prudent conversation where you can say everything that's on your mind about your concerns and bring some data along with that, man, this is the place for you. You wouldn't want to miss out. And by the way, that virtual community, Peak Prosperity, once a year becomes a physical community. We come together. This year it's going to be in Lake Winnipesaukee, New Hampshire, September 12th, 13th, 14th. We've got a bunch of great guests. Here's three of them. James Howard Kunstler is going to be there presenting. Dr. Ken Berry and Paul Kiker. I just can't wait to see these three, plus me and Evie, all of us together. Just what's the common element? Super high integrity, very thoughtful people. And we're going to be talking about the political landscape, the health landscape, the financial landscape. That's what we need to be doing now. And we have to come together, because that's how we learn. And that's how we understand the seriousness of our current problems and predicaments. So we bounce our ideas off of other people and see where they're at. All right. So that's going to be a lot of fun. I would invite you to join that as well. For now, I am going to be taking this back to my subscribers back at Peak Prosperity because I got a very important message from my heart about where we are and a big summation of where I think this is all going. For everybody else, thank you very much for being here. It's been an absolute pleasure spending this time with you. Can't wait to see what you say about economy and the energy piece that's being put together. It's just so important. Let me know what you think. All right, till next time. Bye-bye.